Today is going to be different entirely. For the next 3 hours, we're going to try and twin Illinois Reparations Public Hearing, which will be kicking off in a few minutes at Caldwell Theater in Krannert. Illinois Reparations Public Hearing is presented by the State of Illinois African Descent Citizens Reparation Commission. There's been a more informal public hearing at Church of Living God, and brought some of that to you. Sundiata Chajwa, who is one of the people that's going to be speaking today, has a new book out, University of Illinois Press, that's an anthology of writings about reparations from historical to the present. It presented a bit of that as well in the past. He did a book chat at the Literary here in downtown Champaign. I didn't say my name is Paul Muth. This is News from Neptune, but as I mentioned, preemption. And Gus Woods had to go out of town again. This one maybe on shorter notice. He had planned to be away for a massive conference in Atlanta, Georgia. But I kept him away for a whole week. But since he won't be here for Radio Free Labor, just going to try and let this public hearing run. Let's do some underwriting announcements in a row here, and maybe I'll have the one feature from Amy Goodman, Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, just to bridge into this next hour, since it looks like they are about to convene here. Let's get an underwriting announcement in.
Programming on WEFD is brought to you in part by ShambanaEats.com. Champaign Urbana's only publication highlighting the food and drink scene in Champaign and Urbana. Shambana Eats brings you behind the scenes of the local food industry. Who, how, where, and what you choose to eat next. ShambanaEats.com.
Programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by the Canopy Club, hosting live music and events, including the Piano Man, every Monday night. The Canopy Club has welcomed national and regional artists, rock, indie, hip-hop, electronic, and all genres for over 25 years. Find information on upcoming events at canopyclub.com or by following the Canopy Club on all social media platforms.
Programming at WEFT is supported in part by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County and the Habitat Restore. When you donate, volunteer, or shop at the Habitat Restore, you're invested in building homes, communities, and hope throughout Champaign County. Learn more about Habitat for Humanity of Champaign at cuhabitat.org or follow them on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, perhaps I'm missing something that I should be putting on the air for this this feature, but let's see if we can get back to it. We're going to hear the Amy Goodman Breaking the Sound Barrier commentary, and we'll check back on the reparations public meeting.
Trump's attack on free speech and one federal judge's fiery rebuke. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Judge William Young of the Federal District Court in Boston is a Reagan appointee who's been on the bench for 47 years. Last June, he received a threatening postcard. Handwritten in all caps, it read, "Trump has pardons and tanks. What do you have?" The date is significant. June 19th was just 5 days after Trump's ostentatious Washington, D.C. military parade, part of the birthday party Trump threw for himself and the U.S. Army at public expense. The parade was little more than a multi-hour display of tank after tank rolling by the temporary bleachers where Trump sat among his loyalists. Judge Young opened an order he issued this week with an image of that postcard. He followed with a message to the card sender. Quote, "Dear Mr. or Ms. Anonymous, alone I have nothing but my sense of duty. Together we, the people of the United States, you and me, have our magnificent Constitution. Here's how that works out in a specific case, the judge wrote. What followed was a 161-page excoriation of the Trump administration's attack on free speech. The case was filed by the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, and other academic organizations, alleging the government had criminalized, quote, any speech supportive of Palestinian human rights or critical of Israel's military actions in Gaza, unquote, and was targeting pro-Palestinian visiting students and scholars for deportation. Ruling in favor of the plaintiffs, Judge Young wrote, quote, this case, perhaps the most important ever to fall within the jurisdiction of this district court, squarely presents the issue of whether non-citizens lawfully present here in the United States actually have the same free speech rights as the rest of us. The court answers this constitutional question unequivocally. Yes, they do, unquote. The non-citizens referred to are Mahmoud Khalil, Yuncio Chung, Rumeysa Ozturk, Mohsen Madawi, and Badr Khan Suri. Each of them was in the United States legally and had publicly supported Palestinian rights. As the nine-day trial presided over by Judge Young proceeded, facts accumulated that the Trump administration, and specifically Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, and their subordinates had targeted these individuals for deportation largely because of their speech.
If free speech means anything in this country, it means mass government agents can't pick you up off the street and throw you into jail because of what you've said.
Said one of the principal attorneys on the case, Alex Abdo, litigation director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil, who is Palestinian, spent 104 days in various immigration jails, mostly in remote Jena, Louisiana. The Trump administration still trying to deport him. He reacted to Judge Young's ruling on Democracy Now!
It's very important to continue to speak out, because this is what this administration and this is what the court now confirmed, that this administration's intention was to chill our speech. So I want to continue to speak up against this administration to show that they will never succeed in silencing us, in silencing us against all the atrocities that are happening against our people in Palestine.
Commenting on the cases of Rumeysa Ozturk and Mohsen Madawi, attorney Alex Abdo added,
they were both in court yesterday because the government has argued that they're not entitled to challenge their detention, even if the government threw them in jail specifically for the reason of trying to silence their speech and to chill others. And the hope is that a ruling like yesterday's will break the spell, because the goal of this administration in all of these cases in which it is cracking down on political speech is to silence dissent.
Judge William Young's ruling is fact-based, deeply researched, and peppered with footnotes highlighting historical precedents, previous struggles to defend essential rights, and other clear offenses of the Trump administration. He attacks the current practice of mask-wearing by federal law enforcement agents as, quote, disingenuous, squalid, and dishonorable, adding, quote, ICE goes masked for a single reason, to terrorize Americans into quiescence, unquote. Judge Young closes his order as he began, addressing the anonymous author of the threatening postcard. Quote, next time you're in Boston, the postmark on the card is from the Philadelphia area, stop in at the courthouse and watch your fellow citizens sitting as jurors reach out for justice. It is here and in courthouses just like this one, both state and federal, spread throughout our land, that our Constitution is most vibrantly alive, unquote. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And now we'll go to Deborah Feinman in progress. This is from the Caldwell-Craner Center. It's the Reparations Committee presentation. You can get this live stream, and I'm sure it'll be archived as well. Illinois ADCRC.
It's not just about our African American residents. It's also an opportunity for government to apologize for inequities caused by our policies that harmed our Black residents and to find a way forward to a more equitable community and state. So thank you for your work today.
Thank you, Mayor Finan. Can we please put up the commissioner bios? I will briefly acknowledge the commissioners that are here. For the rest of the commissioners, please go to our website at adcrc.illinois.gov, where you can read more about our commissioners. First, I'll start with myself. I am the chairman of the Illinois African Descent Citizens Reparations Commission. Next, I would like to introduce our vice chair, Stephanie Taylor. Stephanie, would you like to stand up and wave? We can keep rolling. Next, we would like to introduce our secretary, Roger Ellion. Next, we'd like to introduce Commissioner Monique Jones. Next, we would like to introduce your very own, Dr. Jeffrey Trask. Next, we would like to introduce Commissioner Rakisha Falon. And last but certainly not least, we would like to introduce Commissioner Twyla Moore. Once again, if you all would like to read the bios of our commissioners, please visit our website at adcrc.illinois.gov. You can click under the Meet Us link, and it'll tell you all of the bios for the rest of the commissioners. Without further ado, the Illinois African Descent Citizens Reparations Commission consists of Illinois residents appointed to serve as commissioners from across the state. The commission is tasked with researching and presenting findings on Illinois' involvement in the slave trade and the resulting economic, political, and social disenfranchisement of African Americans that descend from U.S. chattel slavery, evaluating the ways to recognize that past, and curating recommendations for reconciliation through reparatory policies. We are focused on these 11 focused areas, with the first being enslavement, the second being racial terror, the third being political disenfranchisement, the fourth being housing segregation, separate and unequal education, pathologizing the Black family, racism in environment and infrastructure, stolen labor and hindered opportunity, the unjust legal system, mental and physical harm and neglect, and all of that culminates into what we know now as the racial wealth gap. Next. We are dedicated to understanding the five W's of each of these harm areas, including the who, what, when, where, and why of these areas. We invite you all today to bring your full selves. We have amazing expert speakers on issues of pathologizing the Black family, mental harm and neglect, and the wealth gap, as well as stolen labor and hindered opportunity. We invite you to listen intently to these experts and then to join the conversation in the second half with your own public comment. Thank you. Now, I will invite to the stage the mayor of Urbana, Deshaun Williams.
Right. Good morning. Good morning. Time is flying on me here. On behalf of the city of Urbana, can y'all hear me? All right. It is my deep honor to welcome you all to this very important gathering. We are proud to host the Illinois African Descent Citizens Reparations Commission right here at the University of Illinois in the heart of our city and in the heart of a long overdue conversation. Illinois stands as one of only three states in the nation with a dedicated reparations commission. And I am proud to say that Urbana is not just watching from the sideline. We are engaged, we are invested, And yes, I was excited to ensure that funding for a reparation study right here in Urbana made it into our city budget. Because words are not just enough. We must back our commitment with resources. See, when I first stepped into this office as the first Black mayor of Urbana, I carried with me not just the hopes of progress, but the weight of responsibility. Responsibility to act, not just speak. That's why I'm proud to say that we didn't just talk about reparations, we are literally taking action. We led the way in budgeting $25,000 for the comprehensive reparations study, a first for our city. Now I know we got some Chicago folks here. I know $25,000 might not sound like a revolutionary number, but let me be clear in saying that this is more than just about the money. This is about intention. For the first time in Urbana's history, we've allocated real dollars to investigate real harm, to look at how decades of systematic racism have impacted Black residents in this city, and what it will truly take to repair that harm. So I want to say thank you to the commission for your leadership. Thank you to our community members for showing up. And let's make this moment count, not just for us, but for generations to come behind us. Thank you all, and let's get to work. God bless.
Thank you, Mayor Williams. Next, we would like to bring up the video of our speaker, State Rep Carol Ammons, who sends her regards. Unfortunately, she will not be here in person because she is attending the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus's policy conference. But she sends her best regards and is willing to share a video with us. So can we please play that video?
On June 18, 1452, Pope Nicholas V authorized through the Dum Diversus the capture of Africans as prisoners of war and trafficked them across the Atlantic and subjugated them to dehumanization processes that resulted in ethnocide. Ethnocide is the loss of identity and place, which is the first harm done by slavery. The word pathologize gives unwarranted credit to actions it describes. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, to pathologize is to view or characterize as medically or psychologically abnormal. The Black family was not the victim of infection. It has been the subject of generational war and policy violence and the denial of full citizenship rights and repair. The period encompassing the illegal and brutal trafficking of our ancestors hundreds of years ago to the present day is a landscape of pain and exploitation. Millions of our people, from the enslavement period to Jim Crow, convict leasing, terrorism, and other domestic abuses against African Americans, continue to plague this country and has found a resurgence in the current moment, amplifying the anti-Black sentiment that has loomed large over the past and the present. Redress must be the outcome to end centuries of harm, not merely the actions of an individual. Pathology obscures our history, blurs the facts, and tries to assign personal responsibility to problems which would otherwise not have existed were it not for the damage done to Africa and its diaspora by way of enslavement, colonization, and neocolonialism. As people that advocate for reparations, we must always remind folks that this problem spans across the entire timeline of the United States' existence. This problem did not die with Abraham Lincoln. The Emancipation Proclamation did not end racism, and the election of Obama did not usher in a new era of justice and repair for the descendants of those captured as prisoners of war and trafficked across the Atlantic for legalized subjugation. Pathology as a supposed explanation for the Black family is itself the product of a racist society. The massive impact of policy violence, not the mythical illness or mythical constraints pathology claims, can be seen across the United States. In the 1940s, the GI Bill denied more than 1 million Black veterans from benefits after serving their country. Medical apartheid, which abused the trust of Black patients, was a series of unethical medical experiments on Black people across this nation. This abuse of health and trust, along with the pseudoscience of eugenics, has contributed to the legitimization of Black pathology. and the redlining of cities like Chicago, which effectuated segregation of living, keeping Black people out of the most prosperous areas of town. In the 103rd District, which I serve, the Champaign County Clerk has led an effort in county government to redress the harms of restrictive covenants. These were legal land documents that as recently as 1960 were used to keep Black people out of neighborhoods, even as tenants, literally drawing Black people out of the most common way of building wealth, which is home ownership. That kind of economic warfare effectively segregated our local schools, funded by property taxes. Those who pathologize or even try to pathologize Black families either misunderstand history or worse, know history and use this misinformation to prevent progress. Reparations must redress not only the direct financial injustices, but must also reform the systems that made the injustices possible. It is a ridiculous notion to attribute the condition of Black people in America to a physical or mental condition and not the policy and physical violence taken against us for centuries. The foundation of white supremacy sits tenuously on a rickety base of lies and deceptions about how whites gained their wealth and status. A century and a half after slavery, the median wealth of white families is approximately $250,000. But for Black families, it's around $24,000. The belief that white America achieved this 10-to-1 wealth advantage by hard work is an absurd and historical fantasy. Not only do they seek to invent a fraudulent fairy tale that whitewashes a very bloody legacy, but they also aim to reaffirm the notion that non-whites are naturally inferior and lazy and thus responsible for having comparatively nothing. Pathology as a supposed explanation for the Black family is itself the product of a racist society. Thank you all for being here, and thank you all for the work that you're doing.
We would once again like to thank State Rep. Carol Emmons for her video. I would like to invite to the stage Naomi Simmons-Thorne to continue talking about the pathology of the Black family.
All right, good morning, everyone. So my name is Naomi Simmons-Thorne, and I am a philosopher and doctorate student based at Loyola University Chicago and also here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm also a research associate with the Champaign Urbana Reparations Coalition. And as a philosopher, I specialize on the topics of ethics and moral philosophy, which encompasses the topic of justice. So as philosophers, we often talk about there being three species of justice. So one of those forms of justice is what's called retributive justice. And this is like the punishing of wrongdoers. And that's the kind of justice that we hear about in law and in courts, and also like in our religious upbringing as well. A second kind of justice is another form called distributive justice. And this form of justice is the kind of justice that talks about giving people their fair share in their proportion. And so this is the kind of justice that Marx talks about. It's also the kind of justice that Rawls talks about, if you're familiar with like him and his work. But there's also a third kind of justice that's called rectificatory justice. In other words, rectifying and correcting wrongs. And it is this concept of justice that's at the heart of the reparations movement, but it's also the kind of justice that has been the least thought about in the history of philosophy. So although Aristotle proposes all three of these forms of justice, rectificatory justice is the least thought about one. And being at the heart of the reparations movement, it's also unfortunate that it's the most poorly understood. But I think it's really important to say that we shouldn't let, and I often hear this, that reparations is just CRT or DEI. when ancient philosophers in the 4th century BCE was talking about this kind of justice. And so this is not just a modern thing or some kind of modern excess. So when I was tasked with, when I started working with the Champaign-Urbana Reparations Coalition, I was tasked with creating a survey instrument. And the purpose of that instrument was that we wanted it to gather state and local data that we could take to lawmakers and institutions and say, you know, this is why reparations is so vital to your constituents. And the instrument that we developed, it differs from traditional reparation surveys. And so traditionally, reparation surveys will just go around and poll people and ask, do you agree or disagree with reparations? And frankly, as a philosopher, I don't even know what that would mean exactly. But for us, our approach was a little bit different. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to figure out, both in terms of qualitative and quantitative questions, what aspects of reparations is most salient for people. And our survey is embedded in reparations practice and scholarship. And so we have 7 sections of questions that we ask our respondents, but I won't go into all 7 of those questions here, but I do want to talk about 4 of the most important ones. So one of those survey questions is about knowledge of reparations precedents. So we want to know whether our educational institutions, whether our centers of public information is doing a good job of educating residents and citizens, both local and statewide, about reparations precedents, like the one that happened, of course, in Evanston or in Rosebud, Florida, and whether our education institutions are teaching about the principles of international law where, you know, reparations is enshrined in the right to remedy and repair for crimes against humanity. We also wanted to know which aspects of in categories of harms are most salient in the lives of Illinois descendants of slaves. And so this information is important because on a local and statewide, you know, level, budgets are limited. And while it would be good if we could just shoot a silver bullet and just sufficiently, you know, take care of the reparations problem, that's generally not the case. Some lawmakers are more favorable to doing reparatory action in education as opposed to healthcare and so on and so forth. And so if priority considerations have to be made, we want to be able to tell lawmakers and institutions, well, these are the priorities of your constituents. Thirdly, we also wanted to know about the social histories of Illinois descendants of slaves. And we wanted to ask questions like, do you know about a event that might form the basis of a reparations claim? Which categories of harm have affected your families most saliently? And by virtue of that, you know, which institutions in Illinois are most culpable? And lastly, we also wanted to know which kind of reparatory action that Illinois descendants of slaves, both locally and statewide, what kind of reparatory action are they most interested in? And so we have gathered about 61 respondents from when our survey launched, and that's not a statistically insignificant number. And so analysis on this data is forthcoming, but there are some, I think, preliminary things I can say about it. One of those things is that, we are not doing enough to educate our local communities about reparations precedents. And secondly, there is favor granted towards compensation, reparatory actions, and also guarantees of non-repetition. So I think that's really important to say. Having said that, I was also asked to say a little bit of something about the pathologizing of the Black family. And you know, I often fear that when people are talking about reparations, that listeners get the impression that reparations is like a backwards-looking movement, which it isn't. And so, what I wanted to think about was, you know, rather than historical cases and examples of pathologizing the Black family, what does the future without reparations look like for the Black family? And as I was thinking about this, I think I thought about what's called like the great wealth transfer as probably like a really good case. And so if you've never heard of this term being used, the great wealth transfer is this idea that, well, let me back up and say this. So it's estimated that they are between favorable policies like low and free college tuition, home ownership assistance, and these kinds of things, that the federal government essentially generated $120 trillion of personal wealth for baby boomers. And now, as baby boomers are passing, that about $70 trillion of that money will be transferred to millennials in some form or another, which is my generation as a Black millennial. So as a Black millennial, you know, I've seen some of this wealth transfer taking place in real time. So I think about a friend of mine, for example, her and her spouse recently received like a six-figure inheritance from the passing of a family member. And it's a really interesting when you think about this in contrast, because my spouse, his grandfather passed away 2 weeks ago, and we went to his funeral last weekend. And while we were traveling, I was asking him, well, you know, are you gonna be in your grandfather's will? And he said to me, what will? And so this is kind of, you know, the disparity that's gonna be like shaping the wealth, inequality between Black millennials and white millennials. And so this is pretty pervasive, and it's a really serious issue. And economists argue that by the time that this wealth transfer is taking shape, that there will be an irreconcilable wealth disparity between Black millennials and white millennials. And if my anecdotal data is any indication, I think it's fair to say that that will be the case. And so I, of course, don't have the answer to this problem. I'm not an economist, but I do know that reparations, you know, is the first step to addressing it. So thank you.
We would like to thank the future Dr. Simmons Thorne.
This is the reparations
next, we would like to call
meeting
up
that's
our
happening at the Cranard
Mental and Physical Harm Playhouse and
Playhouse right now.
Reverend Terrence Thomas.
Again, this is live right now.
Do we have the PowerPoint on screen?
My oh, my.
Appreciate you. Good morning.
This is available as a live stream
y'all
on YouTube.
Better than that. It is early on a Saturday.
The archive
this is
later.
My off day. Good morning. Good morning. It's so good to be here with you on this morning. This morning, I've been tasked in a few short minutes to talk about reparations as sacred repair, why mental, physical, and that, as you saw that I'm a clergy, I'm going to add spiritual because that adds to the other components, harm demand justice. And so for too long, America has avoided confronting the ongoing wounds of slavery and systemic racism. And so my goal this morning with this presentation is to examine why reparations represents not charity as it's often sold as, but sacred repair, the moral and practical necessity of healing generational trauma that continues to devastate Black communities. And so we're going to look at three key dimensions briefly. Physical violence that spans centuries, even until this day. A psychological warfare designed to break spirits, and we are still dealing with that to this day. And the spiritual desecration that attempted to sever our connection to the divine. So this is not a proselytizing moment. I'm just aiming at the years of having white Jesus on our walls has impacted us, all right? The time for half measures and hallowed apologies has passed. Justice delay is denied. Mic check, 1, 2. And the bill for America's moral debt grows with each passing day. Let's take something practical, maternal morality crisis. And so since I have to do harm, let me say to my other speakers, there's going to be some overlap, but I stayed out of y'all pool as much as I can. All right, Dr. Chajua. All right, brother, I tried to stay out of y'all pool, but there's going to be some overlap. But let's talk about something tangible, maternal morality crisis. Black women are 3 to 4 more times likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women, regardless of education or income. And this ain't ancient history. This is not an accident. This is systemic neglect rooted in centuries of medical racism, like dreptomania, saying they're wanting to run away as a medical case. Do we all know that OBGYN, gynecology, that's a field of medicine built on the backs of experimenting on Black women during chattel slavery? When Serena Williams, one of the world's greatest athletes with access to the best medical care, nearly dies from complications that doctors initially dismissed. Serena Williams almost died giving birth. She's a billionaire. She ain't common folks. She got good health care. And they were like, nah, ain't nothing wrong. That's medical racism, has its roots in slavery. How many of us, especially sisters, have been to the doctor? I know my wife is going through some things. And she recently, Commissioner, kept telling the doctor, I'm in pain. And he kept saying, nah, you good. Until I stood my 6'2", 300 plus pound up and said, she says she in pain. And so it was once said that doctors are to Black women what the police are to Black men. Doctors are to Black women what police are to Black men. You don't feel our pain, don't see humanity, and treat like chattel. I'm going to the next slide. Keep the camera moving. What we're addressing. So we're going to talk about physical harm, violence against Black bodies through slavery, lynching, medical experimentation. We just talked about that. Ongoing police brutality. The systemic destruction of Black flesh as a tool of racial terror, mental harm, psychological warfare designed to break Black minds and spirits, the separation of culture, erasure, and the implementation about lies of Black inferiority continue to poison our communities. And this is why we struggle to tell our babies there's a life beyond, right? This comes from slavery. You will never rise above here. And so we even practice that to this day. Don't look it, I'm 50, but I'm of an age where when I went off to college, I was both affirmed and reminded not to get too big for myself by my uncle. He affirmed me, hey, I'm glad you're going to that university. Don't come back thinking you better. And that's grounded not in just keeping you humble, but this nascent inferiority complex that keeps bubbling up. And spiritual harm, again, we're going to talk about the murder of Black souls. Next slide. So physical harm, the body as the battleground. 240 years of enslavement, and that's just a raw estimate. We dealt with whipping, branding, mutilization. The torture of enslaved people served multiple purposes, punishments, intimidations, and the marking of human beings. And then it showed up in our community by something we call whoopings, right? And that starts because mama had to do it so Overseer John wouldn't. And we kept that going. My sister, thank you so much. Amen. Give her a round of applause. Black women gonna fix it. Amen. We talk about whipping, branding, mutilization. Your body's not your own. Your body is property. We talk about systemic rape and forced breeding. Whether you wanted to have a baby or not as a Black woman, you had to have a child. Recently in Georgia, there was a sister kept on life support. She was brain dead, her body was dead, but they kept her to incubate a baby because you're going to have this baby, right? And so they claim it's about protecting the lives of the children, but in fact, it's, well, you're gonna have this baby, you're gonna have this Black body, which is gonna be used as labor for our system. And of course, we talked about miracle experimentation without consent.
even back then experimenting on African Americans. And of course, we all know the case of Henrietta Lacks. We all know the Tuskegee experiment. We know these things that have been done. I'm a hospital chaplain by trade, and I promise you, we're the first ones they offer the experimental drugs to. They don't offer us the stuff that we know is tried and true. We got an experimental drug we'd like for you to try. And so my mother was a nurse, and one of the things she taught me was say no to the experimental drugs. And so these are the kind of miracle experiments. Physical harm after slavery, the violence continued. Over 4,000 documented lynchings between 1877, the technical end of Reconstruction, to 1950. Public spectacles of torture, murder, designed to terrorize entire communities. Postcards were made from lynching. They recently found out, I think it was in Evanston or one of the North Chicago suburbs, that this famous postcard was one of lynching. We know convict leasing systems, slavery by another name. The 13th Amendment writes this in there, that you can still be a slave if you are a prisoner. And so they rent out your labor, prison labor. So a lot of the clothes we wear, we know the old license plate pressing, but now it's into clothing, it's into labor, it's into working the telemarketers, convict leasing system. We know about the Tuskegee experiment. All of this has its roots in implementation in the system of chattel slavery, and of course, forced sterilizations. Over 60,000 black Americans sterilized against their will, which black women are disproportionately targeted. And so Mississippi appendectomies became code for hysterectomies performed without consent. Physical harm today, the past is prologue. Again, we talked about the maternal morality crisis. I won't stay there. Police violence. We struggle with talking about this. Police violence. We all know what happened in 2020, the summer of 2020, when it exploded, when George Floyd was murdered, but that's nothing new. In fact, police brutality is nothing new. We just have the means to document it. But a lot of our movements, like the Black Panthers and things like that, start in response to state-sanctioned violence, right? And even in these spaces, I love Champaign-Urbana. Sometimes our first, not in Champaign, but sometimes in our first space is lock them up, right? And so we wrestle with this notion of police violence, which grows out of the old patty roller system, the old overseer system. Environmental racism, from Flint's polluting water to the cancer alleys, toxic air. And I'm from the south side of Chicago, Commissioners 81st and Troop. We all know what happened when we get by Olive Harvey College. When you start rolling your windows up, and you turn your air filters off because you're going to smell it, right? I remember being a student at Olive Harvey College, and I was about 19, and I was thirsty. I got some water, and somebody said, don't drink the water out this water fountain, because we have those landmines by us. And so black communities bear the brunt of environmental hazards. Our neighborhoods become sacrifice zones for corporate profit. And, of course, I'm not going to keep hammering on the medical neglect, but I want to move us to mental harm, the attempted murder of the black mind. Families are deliberately separated. Our panelists beforehand talked about that. Names and languages erased. Names and languages erased. We were not allowed to use our names. We were not allowed to speak our native language. That was a core part of our identity, and it was erased. Cultural genocide. African spiritual practices, storytelling, traditions, and cultural knowledge systems were violently suppressed. Suddenly, the oral tradition becomes less, and it becomes about the written tradition. Suddenly, the drum ceased to be a viable communication tool. And so all of these things impact us today, which is why we only accept written reports, right? We don't accept oral reports. If you didn't write it down, it's not done. All of that kind of deals with the impact of chattel slavery on us and the big lie, you're less than human. Trauma in the DNA. And my mentor is going to argue with me about this one. I love him. We'll fight over some whiskey. But trauma does show up in our DNA. Modern science has confirmed that black communities have always known trauma lives in the body and passes through generations. The constant stress of surviving racism literally rewrites our DNA code, creating biological disadvantages that compound over time. And so we talk about epigenetics. There's a lot of debate about epigenetics. I am somewhere in the middle, but the reality is there's something to the fact that trauma is passed on to our children and grandchildren, either through our DNA, but also our cultural apparition. So for years, I never understood this notion of you got to be in before the streetlights come on. And then it was finally explained to me the past couple of years by an older aunt, where we grew up, you didn't want to be out at the dark. Anything happened. And it didn't happen from us, it happened from folks coming into the community, folks. So being by the street, like little things that we don't think about turn into these cultural prisons, the modesty. You didn't want to dress a certain way because you'd entice Master John, who would then rape you. And so now these things kind of become cultural norms, not for repression, but for protection, right? And we have to start looking at that. So we talk about the rates of PTSD. Every brother in here under the age of 55, hey man, we get paranoid when the police pull up behind us. We do, because it's something to that. I don't know how this is gonna go. Rates of hypertension in black adults linked to chronic stress and discrimination. I can't get the medical care I need to handle my diabetes, my sugar. Years of shorter life expectancy for black Americans compared to white Americans. As a hospital chaplain, I'm not gonna lie, I get mad sometimes because folks living to be 100, 105, and my uncle died at 58 from hypertension and stress. It becomes frustrating. And of course, spiritual harm. I told y'all we're gonna talk about this, because there's something about that white Jesus on the wall. There's something about saying I'm black but beautiful that has impacted generations, right? So we've been severed from our African ancestral spiritual practices. We have lost our names and language. Christianity has been weaponized, and we see it now as we look up with this rise of white Christian nationalism, which is nothing more than the slaveocracy rebranded, right? This is why they love Charlie Kirk so much, because he was one of their chief promoters of this white Christian nationalism that said that the Africans, the curse of Ham, is inferior and sacred worth denied. And so spiritual violence of slavery created a crisis of meaning that persists today. When people are told they have no sacred worth, their spiritual practices are dehumanized. When the very humanity is questioned, this creates wounds that go deeper, or psychological trauma. It attacks the very core of what makes life meaningful. Yet in the midst of spiritual violence, our ancestors found ways to maintain the connection to the sacred. And so hush harbors, right? The way we flipped and used the Bible, the way we recreated this thing to give us liberation. I'm not gonna spend a lot of time on here, catch me afterwards, but why reparations, right? There's a precedence. So when anybody tells you why reparations, first thing you need to know is that reparations has been paid in this country. The Japanese Americans got it after World War II. Native American tribes have got a form of it, not their full due, but they've been paid billions in land settlements and ongoing treaty obligations. And now, be clear, this is inadequate to the harm they've caused, but they've done something. Holocaust survivors, the state of Israel is a form of reparations. We don't like to say that, but that's what happened. We felt bad because we didn't stop Hitler. We'll give you your own nation and we'll pay for it for the rest of eternity. And even in the country, they got reparations. The victims of 9/11 were paid reparations because, again, harm was done. We didn't protect you. We'll give you reparations. Reparations is measurable, right? On the screen, as you can see, stolen labor value, I'll leave that to Dr. Chajewett. We talked about the wealth gap, health disparity, educational losses. All of this is measurable. All of this is not abstract numbers. These things are measurable in qualitative and quantitative data. Why reparations? Because justice requirements. Again, this professes to be a Christian nation. Leviticus 25 calls for the year of Jubilee. Debts forgiven, enslaved people free, land returned to the original owners, and economic relationships reset. So this is the third reason. If we profess to be a moral and spiritual country, we have to reset in the year of Jubilee. I'm running out of time. This was longer than I thought it was. So reparations isn't charity, it's an overdue bill. And so what would reparations look like? Keep up with me. Direct cash payments, right? Debt cancellation, housing support, business development. It's not simply writing a check, as funny as that Dave Chappelle skit was. It's not simply handed, thank you, caught what I was talking about. It's not really simply just handing out $50 million to every black person. But what would it look like in this county that deals with gun violence if we were to offer free childcare to every person in the space? What would it look like? That means mama ain't gotta work three or four jobs no more. That means daddy ain't gotta work three or four jobs. What would it look like if we provided free health care, right? So when we talk about reparations, it's not just checks, it's different things that disproportionately impact African Americans. So we talked about some of these things. So just for my people in the room, and then I'm done after this because my 15 minutes are up, this conversation is now about proving we deserve repair. We already deserve it. Our humanity is enough for debate. Our ancestors' suffering is enough for debate. The debate, the debt owned ain't enough for debate. We're not broken people needing to be fixed. We're wounded people needing justice. And that's a critical difference. Broken suggests something is wrong with us inherently. Wounded acknowledges that something was done to us and that we can be healed with proper treatment. At this point, I am done. Thank you so much for your time, and God bless.
That's Reverend Terrence Thomas over at Caldwell Playhouse at the Krannert Center. This is the African Descendant Citizens Reparation Committee hearing in town, welcomed by the mayors in both Champaign and Urbana, a scholar, and now Dr. Clinton Boyd, Jr.
Often forgotten scripture in Exodus 3, starting with verse 22.
After this introduction,
God instructs Moses to tell the people to ask every neighbor for articles of silver, gold, and clothing, that they might plunder the Egyptians on their way out of capture in Egypt. This is an oftentimes forgotten scripture, and it provides an ancient example of reparations. Anyway, next, I would like to invite to the stage to speak on the wealth gap, Dr. Clinton Boyd Jr.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Before I jump into my talk, it's very important for me to give honor and praise to the God of justice and the God of righteousness. The God of justice and the God of righteousness is the one who brings forth the light of understanding that can only come from truth that is spoken courageously, truth that is spoken unabashedly, and truth that is spoken unashamedly. And it's my prayer today that the truth that I have to share with those of you all in the listening audience is received with not only an open ear, but also an open heart, an open mind, and more importantly, an open spirit. I also want to acknowledge the commissioners for the work that you all are doing. I've shared this with you all previously, but I also would be remiss not to reiterate that you all are not only doing the work of our ancestors, but you all are doing the work of our present day citizens who are definitely victims of injustice, but through your work, we're bringing about solutions that will make justice a reality for our people. So thank you. With that being said, I want to jump into my talk with you all. I only have a few moments, but I plan to use them in a way that will, again, hopefully bring forth the truth that is needed to meet the moment. Repairing the breach, closing the racial wealth gap through reparations. Is the clicker working? Probably not. Next slide, please. So, what is wealth? Wealth is essentially what you own, your assets, minus what you owe. And so when we think about assets, these come in various forms. You have assets that are financial in nature. This can look like cash, it can look like savings, it can look like checking or money market accounts. We're also talking about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, the like. We also have to account for those retirement accounts. Again, these are all concrete examples of financial assets. We also have to think about physical assets, which come in the form of home ownership through either one's primary residence and or rental properties that they may own that are also in their possession. We also have to think about vehicles, and also something that we don't discuss enough is jewelry, art, and other collectibles that accumulate value over time and become one of those assets that can be passed down to succeeding generations. We also have to think about business and investment assets as well. And so examples of these include, again, ownership in the business, thinking about rental income properties and intellectual property. Patents that individuals own that, again, allow them to accumulate wealth in their lifetime. And if they're lucky, or if their family or descendants are lucky, these are assets that are passed down to succeeding generations. Now, when we think about debt, a couple of examples of this includes mortgage debt, student loan debt, credit card debt, medical debt, child support debt. For a lot of the men who I have the great privilege of working with through my organization, Fathers, Families, and Healthy Communities, this is a form of debt that can get all the way up to the hundreds of thousands of dollars if not addressed appropriately. Now, when we think about what some of the national statistics suggest, on average, black families have $1.1 million less wealth than white families. A recent report that was commissioned by the Chicago Community Trust, the Color of Wealth Chicago report, estimated that the median wealth of black families in Chicago is $0. And again, at a national level, if we were thinking about black men's wealth position, it is roughly $10,000, which is 8 times less than what we observe for white men. Now, oftentimes when we have conversations about the wealth gap that exists in our country, there are inaccurate, misleading stories that are promoted within the public that do more harm than good because they completely ignore the pathways taken towards white wealth accumulation and black wealth extraction. Next slide, please. And it's important to note that federal policies are primarily responsible for the wealth that was built for white Americans, white families, white communities, and the lack of wealth that we observe within black families, black households, and the black community. And so what I decided to do today was to spend some time deconstructing a lot of the myths that exist about the origins of wealth accumulation and the wealth gap in this country by going through various policy errors that speak unequivocally to the racial wealth gap. The first one that we have to pay attention to, because this is technically the origin story for the reparations movement in this country, is William T. Sherman's Special Field Order 15, which is also affectionately known as the 40 acres and a mule. This was essentially a special order that was sent down by President Lincoln immediately following the Civil War. He sent a special envoy, which included the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, and also General William T. Sherman, to meet with 20 black leaders in Savannah, Georgia. Coming out of that conversation, Reverend Garrison Frazier, who was the spokesperson for the group, requested that black Americans receive not only land, but to be left alone. That's another part of this conversation that we rarely talk about. His request was not just for the land, but it was also the ability for us to go create a nation for ourselves, primarily because he knew that the prejudice that existed between white and black Americans in that day was so deep that it would take centuries to overcome. Now, moving forward, General Sherman actually granted 5.3 million acres to go to the formerly enslaved, and it stretched from South Carolina's sea islands all the way down to northern Florida. Now, what happened in actuality was that only 40,000 freemen received 4,000 acres of land. However, after President Lincoln's assassination and when President Johnson came into political power, he reversed all of the progress immediately overnight. And so all of the land that had went to the formerly enslaved was immediately confiscated by the federal government and then given back to the slave owners. What happened at the same time, however, was the introduction of the Homestead Act, of 1862, and I believe the subsequent legislation came in 1865. Now, what happened with this policy is you had 160-acre land allotments going to approximately 1.5 million white Americans, many of whom were also European immigrants coming into the country to continue this settler colonial project within the Western territories of the United States. And it is estimated today that at least 45 million